Hello, and welcome back to the Book Club Commune with me, your host, Ivy Poesy. Today we're going to be finishing up Dialectical and Historical Materialism by Joseph Stalin. This is a very short work, so I'm able to read all of it in a very short amount of time. I strongly recommend this work, just because I think it's very good, and hopefully after listening to it, you'll agree as well. So without any further ado, let's get into it and finish up Dialectical and Historical Materialism by Joseph Stalin. Chapter 3, Historical Materialism. It now remains to elucidate the following question. What, from the viewpoint of historical materialism, is meant by the conditions of material life of society, which, in the final analysis, determine the physiognomy of society, its ideas, views, political institutions, etc.? What, after all, are these conditions of material life of society? What are their distinguishing features? There can be no doubt that the concept, conditions of material life of society, includes, first of all, nature, which surrounds society, geographical environment, which is one of the indispensable and constant conditions of material life of society, and which, of course, influences the development of society. What role does geographical environment play in the development of society? Is geographical environment the chief force determining the physiognomy of society, the character of the social system of man, their transition from one system to another? Or isn't it? Historical materialism answers this question in the negative. Geographical environment is unquestionably one of the constant and indispensable conditions of development of society, and, of course, influences the development of society, accelerates or slows its development, but its influence is not the determining influence. Inasmuch as the changes and development of society proceed at an incomparably faster rate than the changes and development of geographical environment. In the space of 3,000 years, three different social systems have been successively superseded in Europe: the primitive communal system, the slave system, and the feudal system. In the eastern part of Europe, the USSR, even four social systems have been superseded. Yet, during this period, geographical conditions in Europe have either not changed at all, or have changed so slightly that geography takes no note of them. And that is quite natural. Changes in geographical environment of any importance requires millions of years, whereas a few hundred or a couple of thousand years are enough for even very important changes in the system of human society. It follows from this that geographical environment cannot be the chief cause, the determining cause of social development, for that which remains almost unchanged in the course of tens of thousands of years cannot be the chief cause of development of that which undergoes fundamental changes in the course of a few hundred years. Further, there can be no doubt that the concept, conditions of material life of society, also includes growth of population, density of population, of one degree or another. For people are an essential element of the conditions of material life of society, and without a definite maximum, minimum number of people, there can be no material life of society. Is growth of population the chief force that determines the social character of the social system of man, or isn't it? Historical materialism answers this question too in the negative. Of course, growth of population does influence the development of society, does facilitate or slow the development of society, but it cannot be the chief force of development of society, and its influence on the development of society cannot be the determining influence, because, by itself, growth of population does not furnish the clue to the question why a given social system is replaced precisely by such and such a new system, and not by another. Why the primitive communal system is superseded precisely by the slave system by the feudal system, and the feudal system by the bourgeois system, and not by some other. If growth of population were the determining force of social development, then a higher density of population would be bound to give rise to a correspondingly higher type of social system. But we do not find this to be the case. The density of the population of China is four times as great as the USA, yet the USA stands higher than China in the scale of social development. For in China, a semi-feudal system still prevails, whereas the USA has long ago reached the highest stage of development of capitalism. The density of population in Belgium is 19 times as great as the USA, and 26 times as great as the USSR. Yet the USA stands higher than Belgium on the scale of social development. And as for the USSR, Belgium lags behind a whole historical epoch behind this country. For in Belgium, the capitalist system still prevails, whereas the USSR has already done away with capitalism and has set up a socialist system. It follows from this that the growth of population is not, and cannot be, the chief force of development of society, the force which determines the character of the social system and the physiognomy of society. A. What is the chief determinant force? What, then, is the chief determinant force in the complex of conditions of material life of society, which determines the physiognomy of society, the character of the social system, the development of society, from one system to another? This force, historical materialism holds, is the method of procuring the means of life necessary for human existence, the mode of production of material values, food, clothing, footwear, houses, fuel, instruments of production, etc., which are indispensable for the life and development of society. In order to live, people must have food, clothing, footwear, shelter, fuel, etc. In order to have these material values, people must produce them. In order to produce them, people must have the instruments of production with which food, clothing, footwear, shelter, fuel, etc. are produced. They must be able to produce these elements and use them. The instruments of production, wherewithin material values are produced, the people who operate the instruments of production and carry on the production of material values, thanks to a certain production experience and labor skill, all these elements jointly constitute the productive forces of society. But the productive forces are only one aspect of production, and only one aspect of the mode of production, an aspect that expresses the relation of men to the objects, and of forces of nature, which they make use of for the production of material values. Another aspect of production, another aspect of the mode of production, is the relation of men to each other in the process of production. Men's relations of production. Men carry on a struggle against nature, and utilize nature for the production of material values, not in isolation from each other, not as separate individuals, but in common, in groups, in societies. Production, therefore, is at all times and under all conditions social production. In the production of material values, men enter into mutual relations of one kind or another within production, into relations of production of one kind or another. These may be relations of cooperation and mutual help between people who are free from exploitation. They may be relations of domination and subordination. Lastly, they may be transitional from one form of relations of production to another, but whatever the character of the relations of production may be, always and in every system they constitute just as essential an element of production as the productive forces of society. In production, Marx says, men not only act on nature, but also act on one another. They produce only by cooperating in a certain way and mutually exchanging their activities. In order to produce, they enter into definite connections and relations with one another, and only within these social connections and relations does their actions on nature, does production, take place. Consequently, production, the mode of production, embraces both the productive forces of society and men's relations of production, and is thus the embodiment of their unity in the process of production of material values. B. The first feature of production. The first feature of production is that it never stays at one point for a long time, that it is always in a state of change and development, and that, therefore, changes in the mode of production inevitably call forth changes in the whole social system, social ideas, political views, and political institutions. They call forth a reconstruction of the whole social and political order. At different stages of development, people make use of different modes of production, or to put it more crudely, lead different manners of life. In the primitive commune, there is but one mode of production, while under slavery, there is another mode of production, under feudalism, a third mode of production, and so on. And correspondingly, men's social system, their spiritual life of men, their views, and political institutions also vary. Whatever is the mode of production of a society, such in the main is the society itself, its ideas and theories, its political views and institutions. Or to put it more crudely, whatever is man's manner of life, such is his manner of thought. This means that the history of development of society is, above all, the history of the development of production, the history of the modes of production, which succeed each other in the course of centuries, the history of development of productive forces, and the people's relations of production. Hence, the history of social development is at the same time the history of producers of material values themselves, the history of the laboring masses, who are the chief force of production in the process of production, who carry on the production of material values necessary for the existence of society. Hence, if historical science is to be a real science, it can be no longer reduced the history of social development to the actions of kings and generals, to the actions of conquerors and subjugators of states, but must above all devote itself to the history of producers of material values, the history of the laboring masses, of the people. Hence, the clue to the study of the laws of history of society must not be sought in men's minds, in the views and ideas of society, but in the mode of production practiced by society in any given historical period. It must be sought in the economic life of society. Hence, the prime task of historical science is to study and disclose the laws of production, the laws of development of the productive forces, and other relations of production, the laws of economic development of society. Hence, if the party of the proletariat is to be a real party, it must above all acquire a knowledge of the laws of development of production, of the laws of economic development of society. Hence, if it is not an error in policy, the party of the proletariat must both in drafting its program and in its practical activities proceed primarily from the laws of development of production, from the laws of economic development of society. C. The second feature of production. The second feature of production is that its changes and developments always begins with changes and developments of the productive forces, and in the first place with changes and development of the instruments of production. Productive forces are therefore the most mobile and revolutionary element of production. First, the productive forces must change and develop. Then, depending on these changes and in conformity with them, men's relations of production, their economic relations change. This, however, does not mean that the relations of production do not influence the development of the productive forces, and that the latter are not dependent on the former. While their development is dependent on the development of the productive forces, the relations of production in their turn react upon the development of the productive forces, accelerating or slowing it. In this connection, it should be noted that the relations of production cannot for too long a time lag behind the state of contradiction to the growth of the productive forces, inasmuch as the productive forces can develop in full measure only when the relations of production correspond to the character, the state of the productive forces, and allow full scope for the development. Therefore, however much the relations of production may lag behind the development of the productive forces, they must, sooner or later, come into correspondence with, and actually do come into correspondence with, the level of development of the productive forces, the character of the productive forces. Otherwise, we would have a fundamental violation of the unity of productive forces and the relations of production within the system of production, a disruption of production as a whole, a crisis of production, a destruction of productive forces. An instance in which the relations of production do not correspond with the character of production, productive forces, conflict with them, is the economic crisis in capitalist countries, where private capitalist ownership of the means of production is in glaring incongruity with the social character of the process of production, with the character of the productive forces. This results in economic crises, which lead to the destruction of the productive forces. Furthermore, this incongruity itself constitutes the economic basis of social revolution, the purpose of which is to destroy the existing economic relations of production, and to create new relations of production corresponding to the character of productive forces. In contrast, an instance in which the relations of production completely correspond to the character of the productive forces is the socialist national economy of the USSR, where the social ownership of the means of production fully corresponds with the social character of the process of production, and where, because of this, economic crises and destruction of productive forces are unknown. Consequently, the productive forces are not only the most mobile and revolutionary element in production, but are also the determining element in the development of production. Whatever are the productive forces, such must be the relations of production. While the state of productive forces furnishes the answer to the question, with what instruments of production do men produce the material values they need, the state of the relations of production furnishes the answer to another question. Who owns the means of production? The land, the forests, waters, mineral resources, raw materials, instruments of production, production premises, means of transportation and communications, etc. Who commands the means of production? Whether the whole of society, or individual persons, groups, or classes which utilize them for the exploitation of other persons, groups, or classes. Here is a rough picture of the development of productive forces from ancient times to our day. The transition from crude stone tools to the bow and arrow, and the accompanying transition from the life of hunters to the domestication of animals and primitive pasturage. The transition from stone tools to metal tools, the iron axe, the wooden plow fitted with an iron coulter, etc. With a corresponding transition to tillage and agriculture. A further improvement in metal tools for the working up of materials. The introduction of the blacksmith's bellows. The introduction of pottery, with a corresponding development of handicrafts. The separation of handicrafts from agriculture. The development of an independent handicraft industry, and subsequently the manufacture, their transition from handicraft tools to machines, and the transformation of handicraft to manufacture into machine industry. The transition to the machine system, and the rise of modern large-scale machine industry. Such is a general and far from complete picture of the development of the productive forces of society in the course of man's history. It will be clear that the development and improvement of the instruments of production was affected by men, who were related to production and not independently of men, and consequently, the change of development of the instruments of production was accompanied by a change in development of men, as the most important element in the productive forces, by a change in development of their production experience, their labor skill, their ability to handle the instruments of production. In conformity with the change in development of the productive forces of society in the course of history, men's relation to production, their economic relations, also changed and developed. Main types of relations of production. Five main types of relations of production are known to history: primitive communal, slave, feudal, capitalist, and socialist. The basis of the relations of production under the primitive communal system is that the means of production are socially owned. This, in the main, corresponds to the character of productive forces of that period. Stone tools and later the bow and arrow preclude the possibility of men individually combating the forces of nature, beasts of prey, in order to gather the fruits of the forest, to catch fish, to build some sort of habitation. Men were obliged to work in common if they did not want to die of starvation, or fall victim to beasts of prey, or to neighboring societies. Labor in common led to the common ownership of the means of production, as well as to the fruits of production. Here the conception of private ownership of the means of production did not yet exist, except for the personal ownership of certain implements of production, which were at the same time means of defense against beasts of prey. Here there was no exploitation, no class. The basis of relations of production under the slave system is that the slave owner owns the means of production. He also owns the worker in production, the slave, whom he can purchase, sell, or kill as though he were an animal. Such relations of production in the main correspond to the state of productive forces of that period. Instead of stone tools, men now have metal tools at their command. Instead of the wretched and primitive husbandry of the hunter, who knew neither pasturage nor tillage, there now appear pasturage, tillage, handicrafts, and a division of labor between these branches of production. There appear a possibility between the exchanges of production between individuals and between societies, of the accumulation of wealth in the hands of a few, the actual accumulation of the means of production in the hands of a minority, and the possibility of subjugation of the majority by a minority, and the conversion of the majority into slaves. Here we no longer find the common and free labor of all members of society in the productive process. Here there prevails the forced labor of slaves, who are exploited by the non-laboring slave owners. Here, therefore, there is no common ownership of the means of production, or the fruits of production. It is replaced by private ownership. Here the slave owner appears as the prime and principal property owner, in the full sense of the term. Rich and poor, exploiters and exploited, people with full rights, people with no rights, and a fierce class struggle between them. Such is the picture of the slave system. The basis of the relations of production under the feudal system is that the feudal lord owns the means of production, and does not fully own the worker in production, the serf, whom the feudal lord can no longer kill, but whom he can buy and sell. Alongside the feudal ownership, there exists individual ownership by the peasant and handicraftsman of his implements of production, and his private enterprises based on his personal labor. Such relations of production in the main correspond to the state of productive forces of that period. Further improvements in the smelting and working of iron, the production, the spread of the iron plow, the loom, the further development of agriculture, horticulture, viniculture, and dairying, the appearance of manufactories alongside the handicraft workshops. Such are the characteristic features of the state of the production, of the productive forces. The new productive forces demand that the laborer shall display some kind of initiative in production, an inclination for work, an interest in work. The feudal lord therefore discards the slave as a laborer who has no interest in work and is entirely without initiative, and prefers to deal with the serf, who has his own husbandry, implements of production, and a certain interest in the work essential for the cultivation of the land and for payment in kind, a part of his harvest, to the feudal lord. Here private ownership is further developed. Exploitation is nearly as severe as it was under slavery. It is only slightly mitigated. A class struggle between exploiters and exploited is the principal feature of the feudal system. The basis of the relations of production under the capitalist system is that the capitalists own the means of production, but not the workers in production. The wage laborers, whom the capitalists can neither kill nor sell because they are personally free, but who are deprived of means of production and, in order not to die of hunger, are obliged to sell their labor power to the capitalist and to bear the yoke of exploitation. Alongside of capitalist property in the means of production, we find, at first, on a wide scale, private property of the peasants and handicraftsmen in the means of production. These peasants and handicraftsmen no longer being serfs and their private property being based on personal labor. In place of the handicrafts workshop and manufactory, there appear huge mills and factories equipped with machinery. In place of the manorial estates tilled by the primitive implements of production of the peasants, there now appear large capitalist farms run on scientific lines and supplied with agricultural machinery. The new productive forces require that the workers and production shall be better educated and more intelligent than the downtrodden and ignorant serfs, that they be able to understand machinery and operate it properly. Therefore, the capitalists prefer to deal with wage workers, who are free from the bonds of serfdom, and who are educated enough to be able properly to operate machinery. But having developed productive forces to a tremendous extent, capitalism has become enmeshed in contradictions, which it is unable to solve. By producing larger and larger quantities of commodities and reducing their prices, capitalism intensifies competition, ruins the small mass of small and medium private owners, converts them into proletarians, and reduces their purchasing power, with the result that it becomes impossible to dispose of the commodities produced. On the other hand, by expanding production and concentrating millions of workers into huge mills and factories, capitalism lends the process of production of a social character, and thus undermines its own foundation, inasmuch as the social character of the process of production demands the social ownership of the means of production. Yet the means of production remain private, capitalist property, which is incompatible with the social character of the process of production. These irreconcilable contradictions between the character of the productive forces and the relations of production make themselves felt in periodical crises of overproduction, when the capitalists, finding no effective demand for their goods owing to the ruin of the masses of the population, which they themselves have bought and are compelled to burn products, destroy manufactured goods, suspend production, and destroy productive forces at a time when millions of people are forced to suffer unemployment and starvation because they are not enough goods. Not because there are not enough goods, but because there is an overproduction of goods. This means that the capitalist relations of production have ceased to correspond with the state productive forces of society and have come into irreconcilable contradiction with them. This means that capitalism is pregnant with revolution, whose mission is to replace it, the existing capitalist ownership of the means of production, by socialist ownership. This means that the main feature of the capitalist system is a most acute class struggle between exploiters and the exploited. The basis of the relations of production under the socialist system, which so far has been established only in the USSR, is the social ownership of the means of production. Here, there are no longer exploiters and exploited. The goods produced are distributed according to labor performed. On the principle, he who does not work, neither shall he eat. Here, the material relations of people in the process of production are marked by camaraderie cooperation and the socialist mutual assistance of workers, who are free from exploitation. Here, the relations of production fully correspond to the state of productive forces, for the social character of the process of production is reinforced by the social ownership of the means of production. For this reason, socialist production in the USSR knows no periodical crises of overproduction and their accompanying absurdities. For this reason, the productive forces here develop at an accelerated pace, for the relations of production that correspond to them offer full scope for such development. Such is the picture of the development of men's relations of production in the course of human history. Such is the dependence of the development of the relations of production on the development of the productive forces of society, and primarily on the development of the instruments of production, the dependence by virtue of which the changes in development of the productive forces, sooner or later, lead to corresponding changes and development of the relations of production. The use and fabrication of instruments of labor, says Marx, although existing in the germ among certain species of animals, is specifically characteristic of the human labor process, and Franklin, therefore, denies man as a tool-making animal. Relics of bygone instruments of a labor process, the same importance for the investigation of extinct economical forms of society, as do fossil bones for the determination of extinct species of animals. It is not the articles made, but how they are made, that enables us to distinguish different economical epochs. Instruments of labor not only supply a standard of the degree of development to which human labor has attained, but they are also indicators of the social conditions under which the labor is carried on. Marx, Capital, Volume 1, page 121. And further, social relations are closely bound up with productive forces. In acquiring new productive forces, men change their mode of production, and in changing their mode of production and changing their way of earning a living, they change the way of earning their living. And by change all their social relations, the handmill gives you society with the feudal lord, the steam mill society with the industrial capitalist. There is a continual movement of growth in the productive forces, of destruction in social relations, of formulation in ideas. The only immutable thing is the abstraction of movement. Speaking of the historical materialism as formulated in the Communist Manifesto, Engels says, economic production and the structure of society of every historical epoch necessarily arising therefrom constitute the foundation for the political and intellectual history of that epoch. Consequently, ever since the dissolution of the primeval communal ownership of the land, all history has been a history of class struggles, of struggles between exploited and exploiting, between dominated and dominating. At various stages of social development, the struggle, however, has now reached a stage where the exploited and oppressed classes, the proletariat, can no longer emancipate itself from the class which exploits and oppresses it, the bourgeoisie, without at the same time ever freeing the whole of society from exploitation, oppression, and class struggles. Engels' preface to the German edition of the Communist Manifesto. D. The third feature of production. The third feature of production is that the rise of a new productive forces and of the relations of production corresponding to them does not take place separately from the old system, after the disappearance of the old system, but within the old system. It does not take place as a result of the deliberate and conscious activity of man, but spontaneously, unconsciously, independently of the will of man. It takes place spontaneously and independently of the will of man for two reasons. Firstly, because men are not free to choose one mode of production or another, because as every new generation enters life, it finds productive forces and relations of production already existing as a result of the work of former generations, owing to which it is obliged, at first, to accept and adapt itself to everything it finds ready-made in the sphere of production, in order to be able to produce material values. Secondly, because when improving one instrument of production or another, one element of the productive forces or another, men do not realize, do not understand, or stop to reflect what social relations these improvements will lead to, but only think of their everyday interests, of lightening their labor, and of securing some direct and tangible advantage for themselves. When gradually and gropingly certain members of the primitive communal society passed from the use of stone tools to the use of iron tools, they, of course, did not know and did not stop to reflect what social results this innovation would lead to. They did not understand or realize that the change to metal tools meant a revolution in production, that it would lead in the long run to the slave system. They simply wanted to lighten their labor and secure an immediate and tangible advantage. Their conscious activity was confined within the narrow bounds of this everyday personal interest. When in the period of the feudal system, the young bourgeoisie of Europe began to erect alongside the small guild workshops, large manufactories, and thus advance the productive forces of society, it, of course, did not know and did not stop to reflect what social consequences this innovation would lead to. It did not understand or realize that this small innovation would lead to a regrouping of social forces, which was to end in a revolution against both the power of kings, whose favors it so highly valued, and against the nobility, to those ranks its foremost representatives not infrequently aspired. It simply wanted to lower the cost of producing goods, to throw larger quantities of goods on the markets of Asia and of recently discovered America, and to make bigger profits. Its conscious activity was confined within the narrow bounds of this commonplace practical aim. When the Russian capitalists, in conjunction with the foreign capitalists, energetically implemented modern large-scale machine industry in Russia, while leaving Tsardom intact and turning the peasants over to the tender mercies of the landlords, they, of course, did not know and did not stop to reflect what social consequences this extensive growth of productive forces would lead to. They did not realize or understand that this big leap in the realm of the productive forces of society would lead to a regrouping of social forces that would enable the proletariat to effect a union with the peasantry and to bring about a victorious socialist revolution. They simply wanted to expand the industrial market, the industrial production, to the limit, to gain control of the huge home market, to become monopolists, and to squeeze as much profit as possible out of the national economy. Their conscious activity did not extend beyond the commonplace, strictly practical interests. Accordingly, Marx says, in the social production of their life, that is, in the production of the material values necessary to the life of men, men enter into definite relations that are indispensable and independent of their will, relations of productions which correspond to a definite stage of development of their material productive forces. Marx, Selected Works, Volume 1, page 269. This, however, does not mean that changes in the relations of production and the transition from the old relations of production to new relations of production proceeded smoothly, without conflicts, without upheavals. On the contrary, such a transition usually takes place by means of the revolutionary overthrow of the old relations of production and the establishment of the new relations of production. Up to a certain period in the development of the historic of the productive forces and the changes in the realm of the production relations of production proceeded spontaneously, independently of the will of men. But that is so only up to a certain moment, when, until the new and developing productive forces have reached a proper state of maturity. After the new productive forces have matured, the existing relations of production and their upholders, the ruling classes, become that insuperable obstacle which can only be removed by the conscious actions of the new classes, by the forcible acts of these classes, by revolution. Here there stands out in bold relief of the tremendous role of the new social class, new social ideas, of new political institutions, of a new political power, whose mission it is to abolish by force the old relations of production. Out of the conflict between the new productive forces and the old relations of production, out of the new economic demands of society, there arise new social ideas. The new ideas organize and mobilize the masses. The masses become welded into a new political army, create a new revolutionary power, and make use of it to abolish by force the old system of relations of production and to firmly establish the new system. The spontaneous process of development yields place to the conscious actions of men, peaceful development to violent upheaval, evolution to revolution. The proletariat, says Marx, during its contest with the bourgeoisie, is compelled by the force of the circumstances to organize itself as a class. By means of a revolution, it makes itself the ruling class, and as such, sweeps away by force the old conditions of production. Manifesto of the Communist Party, 1938, page 52. And further, the proletariat will use its political supremacy to arrest by degrees all capital from the bourgeoisie, to centralize all instruments of production in the hands of the state, i.e., the proletariat, organized as a ruling class, and to increase the total productive forces as rapidly as possible. The Manifesto of the Communist Party, 1938, page 50. Force is the midwife of every old society, pregnant with a new one. Capital, Volume 1, 1955, page 603. Here is the formulation, a formulation of genius, of the essence of historical materialism given by Marx in 1859, in his historic preface to his famous book, A Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy. In the social production of their life, men enter into definite relations that are indispensable and independent of their will. Relations of production which correspond to a definite stage of development of a material productive forces. The sum total of these relations of production constitutes the economic structure of society, the real foundation on which rises a legal and political superstructure, and to which corresponds definite forms of social consciousness. The mode of production of material life conditions the social, political, and intellectual life processes in general. It is not the consciousness of men that determines their being, but on the contrary, their social being that determines their consciousness. At a certain stage of their development, the material productive forces of society come in conflict with the existing relations of production, or, what is but a legal expression for the same thing, with the property relations within which they have been at work hitherto. From forms of development of the productive forces, these relations turn into their fetters. Then begins an epoch of social revolution. With the change of the economic foundation, the entire immense superstructure is more or less rapidly transformed. In considering such transformations, a distinction should always be made between the material transformation of the economic conditions of production, which can be determined with the precision of natural science, and the legal, political, religious, aesthetic, or philosophic, in short, ideological forms, in which men become conscious of this conflict and fight it out. Just as our opinion of an individual is not based on what he thinks of himself, so can we not judge such a period of transformation by its own consciousness? On the contrary, this consciousness must be explained rather from the contradictions even, of material life, from the existing conflict between the social productive forces and the relations of production. No social order ever perishes before all of the productive forces, for which there is room in it, have developed. The new, higher relations of production never appear before the material conditions of their existence have matured in the womb of the old society itself. Therefore, mankind always sets itself out such a task that it can solve. Since looking for the matter more closely, it can always be found that the task itself arises only when the material conditions for its solutions already exist, or are at least in the process of formation. Marx, Selected Works, Volume 1, pages 269-70. Such is Marxist materialism as applied to social life, to the history of society. Such are the principal features of dialectical and historical materialism. End of chapter 3. End of Dialectical and Historical Materialism by Joseph Stalin. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Book Club Commune. I'm recording in a different place today. I'm recording in my car, so the audio might be a little different. I'm also trying to toy with a new audio setup to kind of reduce the amount of unnecessary and distracting noises that are picked up by the microphone. So I'm in the process of testing out a way to do that where I'm still able to record in a comfortable position. So hang tight while I figure out a way to do that. I'm testing a little bit in this episode, and so let me know how you think this episode went, how the audio quality was. Reach out to me on Twitter, at Moonjunk, at M00NJUNK, and come tell me about what you thought about the audio quality in this episode, and other things as well. That being said, we are done with Stalin. I'm not going to be getting into Foundations of Leninism, although that is also a fantastic work. I'm not going to be getting into it now because I still need to go back and finish Mao. So now that we've finished up Stalin, we're going to go back and read Mao's critiques of the previous work we read of Stalin concerning the economic problems of socialism in the USSR. We're going to go back and read Mao's concerning and Mao's critique of it. That'll be in one episode. And then we're going to move on with other Mao works from there, as I feel are necessary and needed. And then after that, I thought about doing Hammer and Hoe, but now I'm concerned that there might be copyright issues that I still need to look into to make sure it's actually legal for me to record Hammer and Hoe. Other works like reading Mao or Rosa Luxemburg or Harry Haywood or Joseph Stalin, there isn't a copyright issue that I need to worry about when recording and putting these digitally online. But with other works, I need to double check to make sure that there is not a copyright issue and that I am legally allowed to record and put these works online without getting into any legal or cease and desist issues. So it's going to be a bit up in the air for the next work after we finish Mao until I can come to complete assurity that it is legal and fine for me to record Hammer and Hoe. If I can't, I will see about doing a different work focused on the American context. I might see about doing some works written by that were written by members of the Black Panther Party or other people as well. I feel like it's important to get the American context pretty well, considering the majority of people listening are Americans. Sorry to the 1% of Albanians listening. That being said, I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Please like and share, and send this all around. The whole purpose of this is to make these works accessible, especially works that you will probably not find anywhere else, like Haywood and Stalin. That being said, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Solidarity forever, and keep on reading.